Today and tomorrow, we'll look at nuclear energy, peril and plowshare. Today, it's chiefly the peril. And I prefer the plowshare part, but we have to get through this. My wife usually comes to my lectures and gives me a critique on them afterwards. But this is one she prefers not to come to. Although it's one of the subjects that I, among the subjects I discussed with you, other than pigs, it's probably one I know the best. Because it has occupied most of the last 20 years for me in my scientific career. I would like to quote something that you've all read. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom. It was the age of foolishness. It was the season of light. It was the season of darkness. It was the spring of hope. It was the winter of despair. Most of you probably recognize that, and I'll tell you that you read it when you read The Tale of Two Cities by Dickens. Any time in history is a paradox. Most technological developments are at one time a bane and a blessing. And I cannot think of any development in our time that is a greater paradox than nuclear energy. It offers us nuclear power and other benefits that are almost unbelievable, and some of these we will discuss tomorrow, or the specter of thermonuclear destruction. But there are other considerations. So under the general title of peril, I will discuss nuclear war, and then the hazard, and also the testing program, and the hazard of flying overhead over much of the world with nuclear devices, and also under the sea. I don't know if we'll get to that. And then our whole posture, as far as our ABM system goes, our anti-ballistic missile system. I don't know if you realize what commitments you have made as a nation in this regard. And then something about civil defense. And what I'm going to do then is discuss this thing, and then we'll show some slides, and some of these slides will be sort of going over some of the material that I present to you now. Now, relative to nuclear war, it is the most frightening current confrontation of man and his products. I don't believe there's any question about this. Man has developed a great penchant for things that go boom. And this is no more manifest than if we examine right now what we are producing in largest quantity and possess in largest inventory. Now, if I didn't announce the title of this talk, and if I made a survey this morning among you and asked you, all right, what does this nation produce the most of? There's a chance that some of you might say, well, maybe cereal crops, or maybe building materials, steel, if you go by weight, or I don't know, maybe some of you, I don't know what some of the rest of you would say. But none of these answers are correct. The answer is explosive force or obliterative force, which now approaches about 30,000 pounds of TNT equivalent in nuclear devices for every man, woman, and child on the face of the earth. Just a few years ago, it was only 5 ton each. But we've made considerable advance since then. Now, this is the approximated inventory of ours, Russia, and China doesn't have too much yet, but they're getting there fast. And then England and France, chiefly. Now, a couple of years ago, I was appointed to a core group of scientists, there were 12 or 14 of us, I guess, who were to meet and discuss the long-term psychosocial and biomedical effects of nuclear war. This is under the sponsorship, really under the direction of the New York Academy of Sciences. We meet at Princeton. We've had 3 meetings. We'll have a 4th one this fall. And we invite usually then 12 other people in, and we assemble along a sort of tables in a U shape. We sit on the outside of the table, and we have a discussion, and the modus operandi is to interrupt. And we discussed initially the Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We've been proceeding through it, hazards from flying bombs overhead and this type of thing, and ecological consequences and so forth. And it's, of course, a very disturbing kind of a thing, with fighting lightning. And I recommended one of the books from this for this discussion, which is Sanity and Survival by Jerry Frank. Jerry Frank is one of the core group. He's a psychiatrist and an MD, a PhD and MD at Johns Hopkins. Now, this is a rather disturbing book. It's also incorrect in certain parts, which we've gone over with him, or I've gone over with him, and others have too. Much of what he's getting at here is of importance, and it's worth reading. I regret that I ordered these books a long time ago, and they were about some of the village, but they aren't here yet. But when they come, read it, but on some of the technical aspects, there is some question. And I want to point out. That you hear a very good love. And even President Kennedy said something like this: today every inhabitant of this planet must contemplate the day when this planet may no longer be habitable. Every man, woman, and child lives under a nuclear sword of Damocles, hanging by the slenderest of threads, capable of being cut at any moment by accident or miscalculations or by madness. The weapons of war must be abolished before they abolish us. And we heard it as late as last night. Is John Cooper here? Dr. Cooper? He quoted Wofford and said, we have this probability that we can destroy ourselves. Well, I'd like to address this point initially because it is of some consequence. And at this first meeting of this core group at Princeton, many of us asked, well, do we want to rehash this thing again? The answer, on this whole thing, whether we destroy ourselves or not, the answer went something like this from a scientist who at one time had been responsible in policy-making position government, this happened to Ted Taylor. Many of you know the names in this field. And he said that some people believe a nuclear war would mean the end of civilization as we know it, and the destruction of mankind. Others say that it wouldn't be much different from World War II. Others believe that the truth lies somewhere in between. He said, this sounds like a trivial statement. And really, the people who probably know this business the best, although there's a lot of unknowns in it. And although I just got through telling you that probably we have close to 14 or 15 tons of equivalent explosive power for every man, woman, and child in the world, it is not within the capability yet to destroy all of mankind. In spite of what you hear from many pulpits, in spite of what you heard last night or any other time, you can go in and you can say, well, we can do the same thing. Well, we can do exactly the same thing, but we have the capability, of course, of killing every man, woman, and child just by using a few, a few quarts or gallons of botulinum toxin, you know, if we could get it to the people, you see. Or we can kill everybody if we say everybody must drink a gallon of salt water, you know. I mean, there's a lot of things we have where we could kill everybody on earth if we haven't complied, you see. But it's a matter of delivering the goods to everywhere where there are people and civilizations, you see. We can make life pretty miserable, and we can kill an awful lot of people. But I don't think that we have it within our possibilities to destroy all of civilization and all of people, and all people at the present time. I think that's all that I want to say there. And I'm not going into all of the grim prospects of nuclear war, only to say that there are, of course, three things that can happen, or do happen, and are associated with the detonation of a device. And most of the explosive force appears as blast effects, and as fire, and as heat. You see, heat and blast effect is the greatest release of the energy, but there is also some release of radiation. And this is not only immediate, the time of the detonation, but may extend for quite some period of time. Now I'll address that more as we get to the slide. There are other considerations, of course, when one discusses nuclear war, and we had to, some of us were very disturbed at this meeting, because Lyman said, well, all right, so we have an exchange, which is a kind way of saying it, I guess, a nuclear exchange, as say with Russia and ourselves, and say we destroy 90 million people, and of course many of them are injured. But, and so there's some long-term effects, but there will be parts of the United States on this circumstance which will not be affected very much by fallout and will essentially be almost radiation-free. So those people can survive, but with large detonations, with an extensive detonation of nuclear material, especially if some of them are in space, there are problems with this. I think that Barry Commoner, he's kind of a wild guy. He's at St. Louis. He because he's noisy, a lot of people listen to him. But here's one of the things that a lot of people don't realize, and there's probably some truth to it. You know, I discussed on environmental hazards that one of the problems in burning all our hydrocarbon fuels is that we release a lot of carbon dioxide, which acts sort of as a greenhouse effect and increases the temperature, while the opposite may be the effect with extensive detonation. And he writes a scenario here. People write a lot of scenarios for this, you know. I mean, I've read scenarios, so I've got them coming out my ears, and I'm not going to give you any except to mention this, but they're worried that, you see, instead of a heating of the earth, really the inauguration of a glacial area that would once begun would last about 10,000 years, He says in the fourth winter, average temperatures in the northern hemisphere are already 4 degrees centigrade below normal, and the snow line of the Sierra Nevada and the Rockies is 1 mile lower than previously. Isotherms have shifted on the average about 600 miles south, which means Tampa now has the climate that New York formerly had, and Seattle has the climate formerly associated with June, Alaska. The precipitation in Washington, Oregon is mostly snow for one third of the year. We'll have to extend our winter program here then. Where the snow remains in the ground during the summer, still more heat is lost by reflection, and the snowpack at higher elevations continue to deepen and close in the valley. Small glaciers are formed, emerged, and grow. Permanent snow caps are seen on many mountains in the Appalachian as far south as Tennessee. Even at low altitude, snow is found, and it goes on like this, with a period of glaciation in the hemisphere then beginning. So this is one of many considerations. You can think of some of the grimy details. I'll get to probably more of them in there. But one of the things that they sort of forget, and maybe you do too, if you have an exchange in which there's a real compromise of our socio-economic structure, and with all these casualties, which are quite sudden, and which may extend for quite a period of time because the exchange may continue. Chances are they're just not going to deliver the goods and then just leave us alone. You know, I mean, if Russia wouldn't, or some time, maybe whoever we had the exchange with, they're not just going to, you know, blow something here, they'll probably come over and take over, you know, and a lot of people forget about this. I mean, they probably have a reason for it. And if we had, say, an exchange with Russia, there's a very good chance that there would be a land invasion by, if not them, some other country. Even Castor might even try it, I mean. Because it wouldn't be a real big problem to take over a large segment. So the problems would increase, and it's a pretty grim thing to consider. In this whole thing of nuclear war, in fact, and Jerry Frank brings it up, perhaps this is as good a time as any. Maybe nuclear war is sort of like the sun and death. You can't stand to look at it for very long. Or else it's sort of been around, you know, for a while, and Jerry Frank's kind of proud of this quotation by Alexander Pope. In his comment on vice, which he also extends here to nuclear war, a monster of such evil mien as to be hated needs but to be seen, but seen too oft, familiar with her face, we first endure, then pity, then embrace. And maybe it's a little bit like that. I think that's about all I'm going to say here, except that they will be difficult times, especially in the highly populated areas, because of the tremendous casualties, because then the influx of disease, compromising of the water supply and transportation and all this type of thing. In some areas there will be food shortages, however, our food supply that would be available if we can get it delivered can extend for quite a period of time, probably a couple of years. And this has all been worked out, and I think fairly accurately. It's one thing that can be handled. I'll tell you a little more about that when we get into the extent. Now, last year, this country examined its posture again relative to the Chinese threat. As you know, the Chinese have now detonated several nuclear devices. They did it on the last two Christmas Eves. The last one they didn't say too much about, and because it wasn't a very successful weapon. It wasn't really any better than the one they did the Christmas Eve before. It was a dirty weapon, and it was quite inefficient. I think they're still trying to get a real good H device, a thermonuclear, that is a fission-fusion kind of thing. And they'll get it, because it isn't that complicated. And they have some rather bright people there. At least one of them was well-trained in the United States before he got wheeled off and went back. And so they'll make it. And then you see, when they get that, then they're also working very strenuously on a missile system for delivery. And of course, this is the big thing. So it was under this threat that the United States felt they had to examine their posture relative to this. And they said, we won't go for a full ABM system, an anti-ballistic missile system. We'll go sort of halfway. And I'll tell you a little bit about the problem there, because it isn't obvious right at first. And what I'm saying, I mean, it's all unclassified. I have received an orientation and the background for this by the Director of Research Development in the Army. But all of this, I'm giving you today, you can read in the newspapers, you can read in Life magazine. And the last September, Secretary McNamara made a release, and he invited, I think it was Life magazine, in for a review of this. And one of the chief purposes for this interview was to assure Russia, really, that, you guys, we're just developing kind of a partial system here against the Chinese. It has nothing to do with you, Russia. Think? It's only against the Chinese. You can tell how we're doing it. We're not going to defend our cities. You'll still be able to kill 90 million people in the United States if we should start something. It isn't going to compromise this so-called, something I call the balance of terror, or the balance of power. See, this is how we're sitting now. In when you're looking at two great powers, and this is our story up till now, somebody gets something new or a little more of something, so the other one has to sort of catch up and maybe get the advantage, you see? And we've been going like this, you see? Well, we have sort of maybe reached the plateau, but this is a threat to it, you see. This is a threat to it. And this is a big problem, because if we start putting our anti-ballistic missile system to defend our cities rather than just our hard targets, you see, we have a lot of missiles that are underground and are hard targets and will resist a rather heavy attack. So we have a system, a counteracting system, if we are attacked. Now, we are telling the Russians that we are essentially only defending these hard targets and that they can still really do us a lot of damage, you see? Well, there's a question now, you see, because some of our sites selected, for example, are you in Seattle? I think they'll probably put in some of these systems, probably in Fort Lawton, or in that area. There will be some other places where they probably have near cities. And the minute you do that, you see, you are then essentially representing a threat to the Soviet Union that will probably cause them to escalate. And also Portland might say, well, Seattle's getting a defense, you see. They're getting an anti-ballistic missile right in their city. Why can't we have it, you see? And so there will be some pressures like this that you will be hearing about in the very near future. And I'm rather worried about this. And this is very expensive. You see, up till now, I think, or up till a recent past, I think we as citizens and examine these things, and we sort of think that there's sort of an unlimited resource for this type of thing. What you must realize is that the $5 billion initial or whatever it is for our anti-ballistic missile system against the Chinese, means that $5 billion doesn't go for something else. If you're looking at defense, or in the whole defense category, you're probably a lot better off to invest this money in an enhanced tax system. To make your striking force greater. You see, if you're just looking at that, I have other ideas where you might spend the $5 billion. And of course, this also creates, you also change our posture with this relative to civil defense, for example, because you're going to have a lot of stuff going off up here, you see. And the other thing you're doing to them is that you change their system somewhat of attack. I mean, they're going to change to have a lot more decoys coming in, you see, without going into the various facets of this. I don't want to get into that, though. I mean, because everything coming in, I mean, may not have a nuclear device on it. I mean, a lot of them are decoy our system, you see, our defense system. So that we might be shooting at something that's a dud, you see. At the present time, Russia, they have two systems that we know about, and I don't think either of them will defend against our system. One of them is only for bombers, and it keeps it concentrated around Moscow. I think that's enough for the anti-ballistic missile system. It probably isn't enough, but for our time, for the time that we have here, I think that's enough. Because I wanted to talk a little bit about civil defense system and about the bombs over Palmares and a few other things. And also another threat, really, and it is something that concerns quite a few people, Ted Taylor among them. And it goes something like this. You see, at the present escalation of the production, or the increase in production, of nuclear fissionable material, I mean, everybody's now getting power reactors, and probably it is within the realm of possibility that probably 80 or 90 countries could make nuclear devices. And one of the hot issues, of course, is the Arab and Israel segments of our world. But there's a question there. You always have to think of the counter force. I mean, a lot of people wondered, you know, why didn't the Arabs bomb the Israel? It's an awfully small place, you know, and it wouldn't take a lot to sort of blow up the capital and a few other things. Well, probably one of the reasons they did is that Israel made it very clear to them that, well, you drop Mount Haifa somewhere, and we're going to fix your clock. We're going to bomb Cairo, which they knew they had the capability of. We're going to blow up the Aswan Dam, and they probably figured they would have power, and it would really cause a flood. And we're going to contaminate the Nile River with radioactive materials. And this was a deterrent force in that case. But if one of them had it, I mean, if the Arab nation had it, there's probably a possibility that they'd... it would just take a few, you know, and it's pretty well compromised. It sure set them back. But there's another consideration here, and that is this, and this is a scenario that Ted has generated, others have too. It is now within the possibility that somebody could hijack, or during the next 10 years, say, or 5 years, could hijack quite a bit of fissionable material, because a lot of it's going to be in the traffic. You know, I mean, people are always hijacking valuable things, diamonds, gold, and so forth. Well, there's no reason why they might not start hijacking fissionable material. And over a period of time, maybe they could collect up quite a bit. And probably here in this camp, well, right today, there's probably enough of us here who could figure out make sort of a, you know, a kind of a Model T fissionable bomb.
I could get enough help in here, we could probably do it. So that capability exists in a lot of the world. And maybe some group have decided that we're in very serious straits. And this country, the whole world is on a collision course, and we got to stop it. And the way to stop it is to threaten. And we're going to say, all right, we want the world, and maybe the notice will be given to the United Nations, and they'll say, all right, you'll be alert on such and such a day. Huh? And on that occasion, in some remote place, a nuclear device is detonated. And they'll say, all right, now, we got 10 more or something, no? And the next one is going off in one of the major cities of the United States. This will be followed by one maybe in the Soviet Union, one in France, you see, in one of your major cities. If you do not do this, this, and this, you see? As a sort of blackmail procedure. And Ted Taylor feels that this is within the realm of possibility, and that's why he's making a big push to try to get better control, or a very rigid control, that is maintained when so much of this is going so much over so much of the world. Up till now, we of course have had pretty good inventory control. This is very important. It's important in the nuclear industry in which I work. It lost Alamos. They lost 10. They lost a couple of kilograms down there over a period of many years. And it wasn't a nuclear device, but it was an accident. It killed a person. Killed Kelly and injured another person. Of course, he was disobeying instructions as to how he was using a waste solution. But they had lost a couple of kilograms. Now, a couple of kilograms goes a long way if you make the right kind of device. It makes a pretty good boom. I'll show that on a few slides. Or if we don't have time for the slides, maybe we can show the slides tomorrow. I may just show a couple of them today, and maybe we can get the effects tomorrow. But there might be some discussion. I think that's probably enough for that type of a scenario. There's also concern, of course, with this material. You could have, just a small box in a car and park it outside, say, the hall of Congress, and pretty much wipe it out. This is one of the big hazards of this, where you couldn't probably do this with dynamite. It takes a pretty good comfort. Now let's look at the civil defense posture. This is a hotly debated issue in this country. And there are many people who oppose it, and for very reasons. I'll never forget, I was on a subcommittee to the National Academy of Sciences, National Research Council on Civil Defense. In fact, I guess I'm still on it. We haven't had a meeting for a long time. But I'll never forget, at that time, and this was probably 6 years ago or seven, we had a secret place in the east under a big hill, way underground. Sort of a city under a hill, which would be the seat of government in case of a nuclear exchange or a disaster. I think if they were building it again, they'd probably put it a lot deeper. But it was a strange feeling. I spent the day there and with all the computers and the whole stuff. When I came out, it was, I couldn't help but think we'd sort of made the circuit, We started out in a cave and we were sort of made a complete circle, and now we're going back under. And a lot of people are opposed to sort of, I'd rather be dead than have to live in a cave. And a lot of people say if you really go into a strong civil defense posture where you have a lot, you've got gung-ho on this, you not only spend a lot of money, but you're more liable to initiate a war because you feel more defensible, you see, that you'd be a little more trigger happy, you see. Other people say, and also it would be very bad because the children are here, they're separated from their parents, And look at what happened in London following the Blitzkrieg, where those children that stayed were far better off as far as the relations of their parents and their later development than, say, those that were taken out of the country and separated from their parents. Those are some of the arguments that are given. I should point out that Sweden and Switzerland, which are not really warmongering people, have a rather intense civil defense program. They have probably the best in the world. I'm sure it's better than the Russians. The Russians, of course, gone into a lot more than we have. But the Swiss and the Swedes have developed, I think, a very good system and an effective one. Now, in this country, they say, well, we have a civil defense system, and it isn't really great, you know. But in many areas, you have, say, bomb shelters in the basement or something, and they're utilizing basement shelters, which really aren't really gung-ho. Although our posture has been changed a bit lately because of the ABM system, the anti-ballistic missile system, because they're now it probably makes it more safe to go in for a little more civil defense. I'll give you my idea of this in a minute. Some people say that you should just have enough so that you can handle a limited number of populations. Of course, you see, then what a lot of people worry about, and we've heard it in the press, or we've seen it in the press, heard it on the television, all that. Well, if you just have a limited civil defense system, then it's going to be a war, a civil war, because the guys, the in guys and the out guys, you know. The out guys want to get in, the in guys want to keep the out guys from getting in. See? So you have sort of a civil war. Others say just have enough so you can put the honeymooners in there so that you can ensure that we're going to have a population after the whole thing is over with. That probably isn't a bad suggestion. That appeals to a few people in camp, anyway. Now, I disagree, and I talked to Jerry Frank about this. He says that on page 20 that the most optimistic recent estimate of death in the United States from a full-scale nuclear attack, assuming that it had the best shelter and anti-missile system now available, was 50 million. It's a little higher than that, really. But we go along in that 50 million. That may even, he says, it hardly seems worth it. Yet it'll be 150 million less, you know, and maybe it is worth it, you know. And I told him so, and somebody else told him more loudly, the fellow in charge of the research for civil defense in the country, Jack Green. But my idea on this goes like this, that we can, that our posture should be, and I feel rather strongly about this, that whenever we build a school or any federal building, whether it be hospital or some business establishment or government-sponsored building where they have money in school, hospitals, yeah, that we do have provisions in it for emergency. That you go subterranean on quite a bit of it. Maybe you have your cafeteria and quite a few supplies there. And not only that, with the consideration of a nuclear exchange, which I certainly hope we don't have. But there are other disasters. We read about them almost every day. And now as we go into a greater population, we go into more, we had probably bigger explosions of this and that, and involved more people. And there are, you're always reading about it. They have to lay them out on the sidewalk or out in the yard or in some local gymnasium or something, where this could provide a system for this. And we're soon going with a big aircraft now. Now, when you go on an aircraft, it's hauling 400 people, you know. Well, there's one of these going to go down sometime. And I hope you're not on it, but when I'm older, I hope I go down on it because I have good insurance for this. My family would be far better off. But that's sort of the state of things. Now, and I'm going to leave my, I think I will leave my, most of my slides for more, because I have a few other things I want to say about this. And it's sort of in the line. I will say this much on effect, probably. Or I'll save this for the last one. I want to say, I mean, the critical question, of course, is war preventable? Or is it a highly probable event? Well, there are some very disturbing considerations, although it is noteworthy, I believe, that we did manage to get through a very critical phase that probably a lot of you didn't realize, that when most of the advantage was really to the aggressor, and that he could have been firstest with the mostest and really compromised it because we didn't have a deterrent, an effective deterrent force. Before we had our submarines with our, you know, our nuclear submarines with our missiles, and before we had any hard targets, we were very, we were really, had our head and had our neck stuck way out. But there's one thing, and is Jerry here? Baumgartner? I'm going to have to get after the staff. I don't know if I listen to theirs, they got to listen to mine. but it's very useful to have discussions, you see. Often I want to, this is how I challenge them for an exchange, but this is probably a psychological thing. But it's this whole thing. We saw it in Nuremberg trial, or it came out in Nuremberg trial, but this was a little test that was run. The subjects, normal American college students and adults, and they believed that they ran an experiment, you see, and the purpose of the experiment was to study the effect of punishment on learning. Each subject was to present a fellow subject who was really the experiment was accomplished, you know. In other words, if I run the experiment, I said, all right, you're going to run experiments, you students. And we got a subject here that's going to run the experiment, who it turns out is an accomplice of mine, you see. And it was a simple learning task, and they were to shock him. You were to shock him then each time he made a mistake. Every detail of the setting was arranged so that the subject was completely convinced that he was administering shock. In other words, I set up the experiment, and you are sure that this fellow is making mistakes, and every time he makes a mistake, you're going to shock him. The shock was administered by a machine on which the voltage level was plainly marked, starting with 15 volts and increasing by 15 volt steps to 450 volts. The levels were also labeled. 300 volts was intense shock. 420, danger, severe shock. And then the two highest levels were marked only X, X, X. Before the experiment began, the subject saw electrodes placed on the accomplice. I took you in there, we put the electrodes on this person, I fixed him up. He was then strapped to a chair in the neighboring room, you see. The actual experiment involved signaling a series of problems to the accomplice. You see, this fellow is sitting in this room, and we're giving him problems. And he was to signal the answer back. And the accomplice, of course, made frequent errors. It was prearranged that you would present the problem to him. The problem was presented, he would make several mistakes in accordance with a prearranged schedule. And since the subject had been told to increase the shock by 15 volts after each error, he had to increase the severity of the shock. At 300 volts, the accomplice pounded the wall and thereafter stopped signaling answers. At this point, the subject was told to regard failure. Well, I'm telling you now, boy, if that guy fails, if he quits signaling at this, you just keep administering shocks. The accomplice pounded the wall once more at 315 volts and then was not heard of from again. Whenever the subject demurred, the experiment told him, when you quit, if he quit doing it, I would say you must go on. You have no other choice than to go on. You see? The findings are disturbing. All subjects administered shocks up to 300 volts, which is painful shock, and 62% went to the maximum, 450 volts, which was two levels beyond danger, severe shock. Subsequent studies show that the closer the victim was to the subject psychologically, that's a lot less likely the subject was to be obedient. And some of them even admitted that, and it was disturbing to them, that they felt a measure of pleasure when administering the shock. Well, these are college students, and then they see they're obeying this fellow, and you see this is something also that disturbs Gary Frank. He also said this in the closing part. He says, there is no ignoring, however, that one fundamental change in the international system is required for survival, the concept of unlimited national sovereignty, and he feels that you have to have a strong central force for this, you see, an international system for control. And the magnitude of the task, he says, is unprecedented, but so are the means now available for mastering it, and the positive and negative incentives for doing so. The new means lies in advances in mass communication, transportation, and technological gains, and many fields that are knitting the world even more closer together, as well as a budding international organization like the United Nations, and he's hoping that maybe something will come from this. And then these words, like many individuals, this is the last paragraph, will probably not be able to make the drastic change in habitual attitudes and behavior necessary for survival in a nuclear world until they come to the brink of disaster. At that moment, though probably not before, enough national leaders may see bottom before they hit it and abandon resort to war as the ultimate recourse for resolving international disputes. The chance of such massive change of heart will occur in time is very small. If it does happen, perhaps the spadework of all those who've been analyzing the sources of war and working on non-violent methods of settling international disputes will have helped to tip the balance in favor of survival. Now, the only thing we won't show the slides today. I'll show them tomorrow, and it'll be darker in there. But I will only read a couple of things. I always read something from George MacDonald. I'll read those to you last. But to show you sort of the how contemporary the Bible is, in spite of what you might hear to the contrary, that sort of on the effects of nuclear war, and in preparation for this lecture for another part of this lecture, at least for another group, I said I told him I was going to read him something that describes nuclear war, sort of, but it was written a couple thousand years ago. How doth the city sit solitary that was full of people? How is she become as a widow? She that was great among the nations, and princess among the province, how has she become tributary? She weepeth sore in the night, and her tears are on her cheek. Among all her lovers, she has none to comfort her. All her friends have dealt treacherously with her. They are become her enemies. From above hath he sent fire into my bones, and it prevaileth against them. He hath spread a net for my feet, he hath turned me back. He has made me desolate and faint all the day. And this, the tongue of the suckling child cleaveth to the roof of his mouth for thirst. The young children ask bread, and no man breaketh unto them. They that did feed delicately are desolate in the street. They that were brought up in scarlet embrace dunghill. This is Jeremiah in Lamentation. And then these words, it is the Lord's mercy that we are not consumed, because his compassions fail not. They are new every morning. Great is thy faithfulness. And then a couple from George MacDonald. The darkness knows neither light nor itself. Only the light knows itself and the darkness also. None but God hates evil and understands it. And this, until a man has love, it is well he should have fear. As long as there are wild beasts about, it is better to be afraid than to fear. And that's the sad state of affairs. Tomorrow will be better. I will discuss I will show some of the effects tomorrow by a slide, because I want you to understand, because so many people, you know, they have a feeling that just, you know, that radiation, all of radiation is an awful thing. Or in reality, it's one of our most powerful tools in research and also therapy and diagnosis. But I want you to understand sort of the effects first, and it's probably more appropriate that I show that tomorrow, and then go into the remarkable things that we have accomplished and the potential for good.
Yes. When were these danger times that we had in regard to being wide open for attack?
Oh, in the 50s.
You say even 48, 49?
Oh, no. You see, they didn't have many, you know.
Early 50s?
53, maybe 54, 55. I don't remember exactly. You see, the 52 and 53, the Russian blew in 50, 51, didn't they? Their first device. I'll never forget it, and then we'll come to you. I'll never forget it. It's a very strange thing, and I'll forget the rest. I'll remember the rest of my life. It was a Sunday evening, I think. My wife and I were sitting. It was in the fall, and we were sitting discussing something at the kitchen table. Our oldest child, which is his son, who's unfortunately never been to Holden Village, he was just a little tight then. 5 years old or something. And we were discussing, the chief was asking me about this Russian threat, you know, that they just decimated their life. And he just suddenly came to my son that, you know, it was sort of supper time, but it was getting dark because, you know, the days were getting shorter. And he came running in as we were discussing this. And he said, it's getting dark outside. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. I'm going to read it. It's getting dark.
Do you consider it possible that the Russians were right and that we were wrong when in the beginning they wanted all nuclear weapons destroyed? Pope John, you know, said the same thing.
Yeah.
All nuclear weapons should be destroyed.
Yeah.
And we should get a treaty that would bring this vehicle. Do you think that it's certain that they were wrong and we were right?
Well, the problem here is that we don't know their full intention. You know, we have the demonstration of the words of Carol Henry Augusta. We are not to lie to our brethren here. Yes, we do, you know. I mean, I don't come clean with you or with my wife. I mean, we all sort of hold something back, you know. And so we can't even trust each other. And it's a matter of really knowing what their intentions were. I don't think any question. There wasn't any question in my mind, at least, after the last war, that for some time later, that the Russians had it, but not us. They would have tried to invade us and take us over. And by deceit and other ways, they would have, they and quite a few other people would have liked to see us blow ours off and hide a few of theirs. You see, the problem is, and the tragedy of it all, is that and then, of course, you would have a nuclear exchange. You'd say, I got them, and I'm going to drop them on you, so you better roll over and play dead, you know. It wouldn't take very many of these to do this, you see. And if we blew all ours, and they had us, and I don't know how you'll feel about it, but at least in that period, they would have liked to have us get rid of ours and then use what they probably had salted away. You see, an inspection program can't reveal them. It's just a tragedy of it all. And,
look at that once already, didn't they? When they got approved for non testing of nuclear device in the atmosphere. and the United States didn't come in. They, one day they announced that they weren't.
Yeah,
they was no good, and they broke something. So they had, they already pulled the wool over our eyes.
You see, and it was a psychological thing too, because they were really going to blow a big one. We did blow a big one, and I'll bring that up next time. You see, what I haven't discussed with you, and I'm sorry about it, maybe we'll have to discuss some of this tomorrow. You see, this whole thing, the bombs over Palomares. I mean, we live in a nuclear age, and the threat does hang over us. I mean, just that we fly these bombers over us, and then our testing program. We really should reach the point of history in March of 1954. We had two organizations in this country who were really competing for building an unusually powerful thermonuclear device. And when we detonated one in March of 54, we did really reach a point in history, because we realized that we could make them bigger than any target. And the Russians, you see, they wanted to do this too, and they were going to go even where that was several megatons. They were going to blow one, and I forgot now. I used to know. You know that every one they blew, they said we got 50 and 100 megaton bombs. Well, so what? You know, I mean, it's kind of a waste of energy, because they're bigger than any prospective target or such. Unless you're going into the atmosphere, and then you've got other problems. Which I won't go into. But they were using this to as a threat, that's right. To say, boy, straighten up, fly right, Lauren. See, there is evil in the world, unfortunately, you know. And we haven't always helped it. And I don't know how close you people realize that, boy, we were awfully close to one. And the Cuba thing. We were awful close. And had they not told them, we probably would have let them. And there was another case where there was one fellow who was involved with some of these weapons. It was, he thought he'd blow on commit suicide. And you see, if one of these went off somewhere, you wonder, well, did somebody bring it in? It's a bit of a precarious existence. Yeah.
Have you seen the original movie, The War Game?
No. The British one?
Yeah, that's a mess with you.
Yeah, they were supposed to show it at our. Yeah, it's probably a pretty good movie.
What's it called?
War Games. British movie.
I saw the same night as Dr. Strangelove. Dr. Strangelove, you had fun, but the reaction from the night is not to the War Games. It was fun. It didn't have any reaction at all.
Yeah, it's hard to comprehend. It's like Larry's discussion on the magnitude of the universe. I mean, it's really hard to comprehend.
What does this new treaty mean to you, between Russia and
Israel? Well, I think it's a step in the right direction. But I wish I trusted it more. But I will say this, I mean, that Russia today, I mean, if you take a look, I mean, they don't want war. There's a very reason for this. I think anybody is crazy for wanting it, especially in these times. But we will continue to have war. But the probability for a nuclear exchange is I think, cardinal.
Thinking of
Russia, or thinking of the
red Chinese,
my dad is a. Well, it depends on what kind of a madman you're. And this is a point that Jerry Frank makes, and it is disturbing to me. We have had operatives in even our country in positions of very great responsibility, people who were not capable to make decisions for reasons of mental incapability. This is true of President Roosevelt during his later days. This was true for a time with President Eisenhower. Certainly this was very true with Forrestal. He should have been committed long before, and at that time he was Secretary of Defense and had a lot of power. And he was cuckoo as could be. He really was. And this is a frightening thing, you see. This is a very frightening thing, and I don't know what mail would pull Ho Chi Minh. I mean, how do you diagnose a guy that's like Ho Chi Minh? He polished off. He was responsible for the death of close to a million people, and he took over and by an organized means to compromise the leadership of South Vietnam. He polished off probably close to 90,000 of the leadership in South Vietnam by design. You see. Well, what else will these guys do? Mao Zedong. I mean, how many people polished off? I mean, millions of people. So you don't trust them. It's sort of the nature of the universe. I wish there was some nice solution to it, you know. And that's why, I mean, what does 80% of your money go for, 80% of our tax dollar is spent to pay for the last wars and the preparation for the next. 80%. And on that disturbing note, I will close. I'll be willing to talk to any of the some things are not settled by anything but much prayer and fasting.
Tomorrow will be a more happy day.